Can you speak?
Very good. You can hear me?
We can hear you fine. Okay, it's all yours. Thank you very much.
Very good. So I'd just like to review some of the issues that we were looking at previous in previous sessions. We're discussing the attempts to find ta'amim for the mitzvot, reasons for the mitzvot, and we have posed various questions such as, is it good to be looking for a ta'amim for the mitzvot? You might find the wrong explanation. Other problems that could be involved. We saw a text that suggests that there's a certain danger involved in coming up with the with an explanation. This is the reason for the mitzvah. Somebody might decide, well, it's possible for me to accomplish that without performing the mitzvah. We also saw a lengthy dispute about, well, do all the mitzvot actually have ta'amim? Are there reasons to find for all of the mitzvot? And we saw comments of Rashi, who said about the various rules that are called chukim, he says, she'in lahem ta'am. They just don't have a reason. And we saw that Rambam said that you can find two opinions in Jewish law. One opinion says that, in Jewish thought, one opinion says the mitzvot do have reasons for them, and the other opinion says that they don't, and that there's something better about them not having reasons, that there's something holier involved if they don't actually have reasons. And Rambam is very, very upset at this approach. He truly dislikes this approach. Rambam, the rationalist, wants the Torah to be rational, wants the Torah to make sense. And we saw, last time, we saw a dispute between Rambam, Rav Moshe ben Maimon, and Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, about a dispute about whether there is a dispute. Rambam said there's a dispute. Some people in Jewish law think that the mitzvot don't have any reasons for them, and it's good for them not to have reasons. And Ramban said, no, that's not true. Everybody thinks that there are reasons for the mitzvot. There isn't a dispute in Jewish law. This came down to a couple of texts that we saw last week that... A text that says, what does God care whether you slaughter an animal from the front of the neck or from the back of the neck? The mitzvot were only given litzarif et habriyot. And Rambam understood litzarif et habriyot to mean to test people, that they're just there for a test. That. And Rambam disagreed with that midrash. But he said, that's what that midrash means, that there's no reason for it. And Ramban said, no, that's not what litzaref means. Litzaref means to refine, to make people better. And that all of that midrash was saying was that God does not benefit from the observance of mitzvot, but human beings, definitely, God would not be asking us to do something that doesn't benefit us. Of course, the things that God wants us to do are things that will be beneficial to us. So we saw a dispute of the understanding of this phrase, litzaref et habriyot, and we also saw a dispute about how to understand what the Gemara said about shiluach haken, about the mitzvah, that when you find a bird's nest or with eggs or with baby birds in it, and also in the bird's nest, you have a mother bird there. You have to send away the mother before you're allowed to take the eggs. And the Gemara said that it's forbidden to say in your prayers, may your mercy, God, reach us the same way that it reached this bird's nest. And then the Gemara explains that the problem with it is that actually this mitzvah is just a gzeirah. So this seems to be yet another text that is saying that what Rambam said, that there is an opinion like this in Jewish circles, that mitzvot don't have any specific reason for them. And it seems like the Gemara is promoting that kind of attitude. And that's what Rambam said. Look, I told you there are two opinions about mitzvot, and the Gemara is promoting the opinion that the mitzvot do not have, this specific passage of the Gemara is promoting the opinion that the mitzvot do not have any reason for it, but we subscribe to the other opinion. And yet, despite this clear sentence in the Gemara, this clear statement in the Gemara, we saw last week a number of attempts to figure out what the reason is, what the tam hamitzvah is, what's the reason behind the mitzvah of sending away the mother bird. And that's where I'd like to pick up today with yet another text on this same topic. We'll move on from birds very soon, but one last kick of the can of a, everyone can see the text, I hope. Very good. Okay. Rashbam, Rabbi Samuel Ben Meir, Rashi's grandson, some of you might know, my favorite Bible commentator, the one who I have written most of my scholarship about. Here's what Rashbam says about the mitzvah of do not take the mother together with her young. He says, I'll read the Hebrew and then the English, Lefi derech eretz v'litshuvat haminim kvar perashti belot v'ashel gedi b'chalev imo v'chein b'oto v'bino shedome la'achzariyut v'ra'avtanut lakachat v'lishchot u'levashel v'la'echol em uvanim yachad. He writes, I already offered this explanation, which is both in conformance with the way of the world and also appropriate for rebutting the heretics. We'll get back to that phrase in a second. Appropriate for rebutting the heretics, lichuvat haminim. So I already offered this explanation concerning boiling a kid in its mother's milk or slaughtering it and its young. The two other mitzvot that we know, that one is not allowed, of course we know, lot bashel gedi b'chalei v'imo, but also there's a mitzvah of oto ve'et b'no lot ishchatu b'yel mechad, you're not allowed to kill the mother animal and its young on the same date. This behavior, either taking the mother and the young together, or slaughtering them together, or cooking them together, all of these things are forbidden because it appears cruel and gluttonous. That this is a sign of cruelty. Now, there's nothing particularly new about Rashbam's comment here. We've seen this explanation being offered before. It is somewhat surprising that he's kind of ignoring the Talmudic principle that said that it's just gzeirot, but he's saying that he's offering this explanation, which is in conformance with the way of the world, but it's also appropriate for rebutting the heretics. The heretics in Rashbam's writings and in the writings of most Ashkenazic Jews in medieval times means the Christians. And so Rashbam is telling us that here's a good answer. If you ever find yourself in a discussion with the Christians about this mitzvah, here is my suggestion to you. And he has, I don't know, somewhere around a dozen times in his commentary on the Torah, he says that some explanation that he is offering is lichuvat haminim. It's a good way of rebutting what the Christians have to say. Now, I'll just mention that he says here that the same explanation here, and also for lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. When you look at what Rashbam wrote about boiling a kid in its mother's milk, he also talks about cruelty and gluttonousness, but he doesn't mention the Christians when he wrote about lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo. And here he's saying that this answer that I'm giving which is the same explanation for Lo Tevashel Gedi Bachalei Dimo and for Shiluach HaKen, is appropriate for rebutting the heretics. A professor here in Israel, Professor Elazar Tuitu, Zichrono Livracha, who was the great Rashbam scholar of the generation of people who are just a little bit older than I am, Professor Tuitu pointed out, you can see from here, Rashbam is saying what he is saying here about this is appropriate for arguing against the Christians. He didn't say that when he wrote about Lo Tevashel Gedi Bachalei Dimo, not boiling a kid in its mother's milk. From this, Professor Tuitu concluded, and I think correctly, that Rashbam doesn't always point out that an explanation that he thinks is a good anti-Christian polemical explanation is anti-Christian polemical. Sometimes he points that out, sometimes he doesn't. Here he mentions that an explanation that I offered back in Sefer Shmot was actually offered as a refutation of what the Christians have to say. And so Professor Tuitu argued that a lot of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah might be one of the major purposes that he had might be refuting what the Christians are saying. Okay, so we know Rashbam is putting his explanation here of Ta'amei HaMitzvot into this framework of anti-Christian polemic, of an argument with the Christians. Back in the day when I was a university student, I had a professor whom I really liked who taught us that reading a text is sometimes like listening to one end of a telephone conversation. We all do this every once in a while. Our wife, our mother, our daughter, our brother is on the telephone, and we're listening to one end of the telephone conversation, and we hear that, but we're trying to figure out, well, what are they saying on the other end? When my wife just said, sure, of course. What is she saying? Sure, of course. So this professor said that that's what you have to do very often when you're reading a text. Rashbam says here, here's an appropriate thing that you can say when you get into an argument with a Christian about this text. So what's the Christian saying about this text that Rashbam feels that he has to rebut, he has to come up with a tshuva, he has to come up with an explanation that will set aside what the Christians said about this text. So we don't know for sure. Of course, every time you play this game with a telephone conversation, you never know for sure whether you got it, whether you got it correctly, trying to figure out what was said on the other end of the telephone line that you can't hear. I can think of two possible possibilities. Maybe other people can think of further possibilities. But I can think of two possibilities of what Rashbam might be thinking here. I think that the second one is the correct one and not the first one. So the first one is that Christians sometimes argue that Christianity is the religion of love and mercy and that Judaism is the religion of strict justice, and that therefore Rashbam feels that he wishes to point out that there also are elements of compassion and avoiding cruelty and things like this, and mercy in the Torah. Okay, it's possible that might be what's happening here, but I don't, as I said, I don't really think that that's what's happening here. I think that what is happening here is that Christians are saying these laws are nonsensical. Now, what does it mean for a Christian to say these laws are nonsensical when the Christians actually believe in the holiness of the Hebrew Bible that they call the Old Testament? So why would they say that these laws are nonsensical? Because of a common Christian argument that goes back to the New Testament itself, and it continues through most of history, that the Hebrew Bible is supposed to be read as an allegory and not read literally, and that only foolish Jews think that the Hebrew Bible is to be read literally, that the laws of the Hebrew Bible are to be read literally. And so because of this, many Jews through the ages, and we'll see this today, many Jews through the ages felt the necessity of explaining the reasons for mitzvot in order to refute the Christian claim that these mitzvot on the literal level do not make any sense, and that's why they have to be understood on the allegorical level. We see this in maybe 100, 150 years after the days of Rashbam in a book called the Nitzachon Yashan. Nitzachon doesn't really mean victory in medieval Hebrew. It means polemic. It means this is the old book of polemic, the old book of arguments between Jews and Christians. We do not know who wrote this book. It was written by some knowledgeable Jew in the 13th century. In Germany, and he refutes various Christian arguments, and he refutes these arguments in extremely strong language, and that is probably the reason why we don't know the name of the author. The author probably kept his name secret. He didn't want the book attributed to him. He would have gotten into trouble for writing a book like this in Germany. One of the ways in which this book was preserved was there was a Christian who collected all sorts of Jewish anti-Christian works, and he published them in a book called Tela Ignea Satani, which means the fiery arrows of Satan. And of course, the Jews are Satan. And so this is a collection of nasty Jewish writings against Christianity. This passage isn't one of the nastier passages, but it's really an interesting passage because the author here of Nitzachon Yashan is quoting things that he hears from the Christians. I'll just read this in English to save time. Similarly, they, the Christians, say about the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, that it prefigures the execution of the hanged one. That's what he calls Jesus. He calls them Hatalui. Many Jews in the Middle Ages called Jesus Hatalui. So the Korban Pesach is there to prefigure the fact that a more important sacrifice will take place later in history on or around Passover, and that is the sacrifice of Jesus. And this is very common, dating back already to the New Testament, to the Gospel of John, the connection between the Korban Pesach and the killing of Jesus. And then he says, there are indeed many verses that they interpret as references to the hanged one. In fact, they do this a lot, says the Jewish author of Nitzachon Yashan. The Christians do this a lot. And they turn to us and they say, fools, we know that the Torah was given to you and not to us. Why then do you not perceive its nature? Why do you not consider the apparently peculiar nature of the laws which God commanded you, such as eat not of it raw, nor cooked at all with water, nor shall you break a bone in it? So he's quoting the Christians as saying to him, don't you understand that God couldn't care whether we eat the Korban Pesach boiled or roasted? What difference does it make whether you break a bone of the Korban Pesach or not? He says, shotim, you know, fools, you must be foolish, says this Christian being quoted by the Nitzachon Yashan, to take these things literally and not realize that the allegorical meaning is the only level of meaning for this text. I really like the continuation of this text. He's still quoting the Christian who's saying, "My nafkamine imhu mevushalim lav." I love that he puts into the mouth of the Christian this Talmudic Aramaic phrase. What's the nafkamine? What difference does it make whether we boil the Korban Pesach or roast the Korban Pesach? V'chein harbe ba'ota parasha madua kol zeh v'chi atem behemot shelo targishu mazeh haremez. The Christians are saying, indeed, there are many peculiarities in that passage, and what could be the reason for them? Are you truly animals that you do not perceive what these things symbolize? So that's what Christians were arguing, that Jews were just stupid people who don't realize when they're reading an allegorical text, they don't realize that they're reading an allegory, and they insist on taking it literally, and they think that God really cares whether somebody breaks a bone of the Korban Pesach or doesn't break a bone of the Korban Pesach. So you can imagine that an attitude like this, which Jews were encountering, Jews who were living in Ashkenazic countries and who were talking on occasion about the Bible with their Christian neighbors, and they were encountering this attitude, and they were encountering Christians saying to them, there isn't any reason for any of these mitzvot, so they can't be taken literally, therefore they have to be allegorized. Sometimes Christians just said, are you guys just animals that you haven't perceived this? Sometimes also, as Joshua Trachtenberg proved in his book about Jews and magic, sometimes Christians, in medieval Christians, assumed that Jews must have been into sorcery, because, you know, if you walk into a Jewish home and somebody offers you a cup of coffee with some milk in it, and you pick up a spoon to mix the coffee, and they say, "Oh no, that's, you can't use that spoon. You have to use this spoon." That Christians who didn't have a system of laws of this nature often thought that the Jews were indulging in sorcery when they were doing things of this nature. Whatever the Christians were saying, there was extremely strong impetus for Jews to come up with reasons for this mitzvah. In the continuation of this text from Nitzachon Yashan, he actually does something that I've never seen a Jewish author do before. It's not on topic of our topic here, but I'll tell you what he does. He offers a Jewish allegorical interpretation of the Korban Pesach, as if to say to the Christians, you feel that this text has to be understood allegorically? Okay, let's understand it allegorically. And then he takes all the details of the Korban Pesach and comes up with some message of strong Jewish pride that is related to it, instead of finding that it allegorizes the coming and the crucifixion of Jesus. For those of you who don't know, just a couple of passages from the New Testament where you see how important allegorical understandings of texts are. These are the earliest books of the New Testament, were the ones that were written by Paul in the middle of the first century, saying, for a person isn't a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is true circumcision something external and physical. Rather, a person is a Jew who is one inwardly, and the real circumcision is a matter of the heart. It is spiritual, and it is not literal. Yes, there's an important mitzvah in the Torah to be circumcised, but it isn't meant literally. It just means that your heart should be circumcised, and that's what is important. Another passage from another letter of Paul: circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but obeying the commandments of God is everything. Now, when a Jew reads a passage like this, we scratch our head. Wait a second. Obeying the commandments of God is everything, but circumcision is one of the most important commandments of God. Ah, but Paul says, obviously, circumcision was not meant to be taken literally. It is to be understood allegorically, and the Jews are overly literal in their understanding of the Hebrew Bible. Those of us who are interested in pshat, in the plain meaning of the Hebrew text, sometimes we have the opposite problem that the early Christians and the medieval Christians had. We say to ourselves, gee, why is the rabbinic literature so far away from the simple meaning of the Hebrew text? But the Christians actually raised the objection that it seems that the Jews err by taking the Bible so literally. And maybe just one more text from Paul that demonstrates this idea, this approach to the Bible. There's a funny text here. Paul has visited the city of Corinth, and he has preached to them the truth of this old religion, new religion that he's teaching. And somebody starts to complain about the fact that he wanted to get some kind of salary from the community. And so he gives a speech here about why it's okay to accept a salary for being a preacher. Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? You know, when you go to the army and you serve, you don't do it at your own expense. Who plants a vineyard and doesn't eat its grapes? Who tends a flock and doesn't drink the milk? You know, if you take care of the flock, you get to drink the milk. If you plant the grapes, you get to eat them. Do I say this merely on human authority? Doesn't the law say the same thing? For it is written in the law of Moses, Lo tachsom shor bidisho, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain. And then Paul says, is it about oxen that God is concerned? Does God care whether the ox has something to eat or doesn't have something to eat? That's of course God wouldn't care about something like that. You shouldn't take that literally. Surely he says this for us, doesn't he, when he says that the ox that is treading out the grain should be allowed to eat? It's actually talking about people like me who are working so hard preaching that I should be allowed to get a salary. Yes, this was written for us, because whoever plows and threshes should be able to do so in the hope of sharing in the harvest. If we have sown spiritual seed among you, is it too much if we reap a material harvest from you? I've done wonderful things for you. Is it terrible that I'm getting a salary for doing it? This, if others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? If you pay the garbage collectors in your community, shouldn't you be paying the preachers in your community? And how does he know this? He knows this from the Torah, because the Torah says, Lo tachsom shor bidisho, and the Torah obviously couldn't be talking about a shor. It couldn't be talking about an ox, because why would the Torah care about oxen? It must be that it's talking about human beings. Later on, I'm going to put up these slides. Rabbi Kelman will put them up on the website. I just threw in a slide here that I didn't bother translating into English, a little article that I found in Haaretz from a couple of years ago that tells a story from 1951, where the Jewish agency had a comptroller or something like this who did an investigation of what was going on in the Jewish agency, and it was found that some of the bureaucrats who were working for the Jewish agency were making money from were skimming off money from the public purse, and the Attorney General of Israel at the time decided who later went on to become a Supreme Court justice here in Israel, decided to open criminal procedures against these people who were taking advantage of the position that they had working for the Jewish agency and getting financial benefit from it. And then Levi Eshkol, who was not yet the Prime Minister of Israel, but he was the member of the government who was in charge of everybody who was working for the Jewish agency, he was asked for his comment about this, and he said, "Lo tachsom shor b'disho." Don't muzzle an ox while it's treading. And the article goes on to say that all hell broke loose. That Levi Eshkol seemed to be condoning this kind of corruption. But so the idea. Is it possible that Levi Eshkol knew the text in 1 Corinthians? I don't think so. It's possible, I guess, but it's unlikely. But he also understands that, maybe it's talking about people that if they're working hard, they should be allowed to get financial benefit. Okay, that's just an aside comment. So Paul is making the point here in this text that obviously you wouldn't want to interpret this text literally. It doesn't make any sense to interpret it literally. So how do Jews react to this? Here's another polemical work, also from the 13th century. This is 13th century France. The last one we had was 13th century Germany, the Nitzachon Yashan. This is a book called Sefer Yosef HaMekaneh. Yosef Official was his name. He lived in northern France, and he records various discussions that he had with Christians. Perhaps before we read this text, I will provide a trigger warning, as they do in the universities these days. I don't at all agree with the theology in that Yosef HaMekaneh, that Yosef Official presents in this passage. And I'm also a little troubled by the slightly sexist nature of the passage, but in the 13th century, there wasn't a lot of feminism. So I apologize ahead of time for if anybody finds this to be a sexist passage. But despite all that, I think it's an interesting historical passage. Shalani Galachachad, once a priest who was looking at a piece of roasted pork, asked me, "What would your God lose if you were to eat pork?" What would God lose if you ate chazir? Amartilo, I said, okay, let me tell you a story about a man and his wife. The man says to her, take off your scarf. And she did that. And then he said, call the cat to come over and sit on your knees. And she did that. And then he said, tie your scarf around the cat. And she did that. Had he said to her, go buy us some food so that we don't starve, that would have been a logical request. Had she fulfilled that request, her love would not have been demonstrated. I'm sorry, I left out the word been, would not have been demonstrated. But when he gave her irrational and absurd things to do, and she did them, her love was thus proven. Similarly, when God, our master and our lover, commanded us not to murder or commit adultery or steal, and we observe those laws, it simply makes sense to observe those laws. Our love for our Creator is not thus demonstrated. Ah, but when God commanded us not to eat pork and laws like that, which people find astonishing and ask, what good do these laws do? When we observe laws of that nature, our love for the Creator is demonstrated. This proves that we love God. So this is still a Jew who's trying to avoid Ta'amei HaMitzvot, or trying at least to avoid Ta'amei HaMitzvot in this discussion that he is having with this Christian priest who's looking at a delicious-looking piece of pork. He's not telling him what's wrong with eating pork. He says that this is our way of showing the love that we have for God. Because when we observe the rational mitzvot of the Torah, such as lo tirzach, lo tinaf, lo tignov, that doesn't prove that we love God. But when we observe these irrational laws, things that shebnei adam tomhin aleihem, that people find astonishing, And they say, Ma to'elet yesh b'chach? So our answer is, there is no to'elet. It just shows that we love God. So this seems to be an example of what Rambam had written that we saw in a previous session, that he said that there are people who think that it's the best thing about mitzvot is that they shouldn't have a reason for them. Yosef HaMekane, Yosef Oficial, is giving an impassioned speech about the value of having laws that show our love for God without having any kind of rational basis for it. What I found interesting about this text is the idea that love between human beings, according to Yosef Oficial, and you can take away the one-sided nature of this. You can say this in a non-sexist manner and just talk about a person and the person's spouse. And the suggestion here is that if you do things for your spouse that are logical and that make sense, you haven't demonstrated love. But if you are willing to do things for your spouse, even though they are illogical, but that's what your spouse wanted you to do, that shows love. Whenever I look at this text, it makes me think a little bit about what love actually is. And Yosef HaMekaneh is trying to transfer this to the mitzvot and say that if we don't find reasons for the mitzvot, that's totally, totally fine. But throughout most of history, Jews tried to avoid these kind of approaches. Justin Martyr was one of the church fathers who wrote in the second century, and he has a dialogue with a Jew by the name of Trypho. This is, we don't know of any Jews named Trypho. Somebody once suggested that Trypho could be Tarfon, but I think that that's extremely unlikely. The timing works out. Justin Martyr is living in the days when Rabbi Tarfon lived, but like most people who write religious dialogues, I don't think that Justin Martyr had a tape recorder with him and was actually recording what the Jew said in the discussion with him and faithfully putting it down on paper. He's writing a book that's trying to convince people to adopt the new Christian faith. And he's got this straw man Jew there named Trypho. And Trypho at one point says, "It doesn't seem good to me, as it does to most Jews, only to say that it was God's will." So, when you come up with these mitzvot and you say to me, what's the idea behind these mitzvot? I don't like just saying that it's God's will. That is always the sly stock reply of those who cannot answer the question. As I said, it's not certain that there's a Jew who ever actually said this, but Justin Martyr is putting those words into the mouth of a Jew, that a Jew is realizing you have to come up with an explanation. You have to figure out, and I think that somebody like Rashbam and like so many other Jews living in Christian countries were motivated at an extremely strong motive to indulge in ta'amei ha-mitzvot because they wanted to refute the claim of the Christians that the laws of the Torah ought to be allegorized and that the laws of the Torah make no sense on the literal level. More often, aside from doing Tamei HaMitzvot, in addition, Jews often also attacked the Christian idea of allegory. Just in the Parsha of a couple of weeks ago, Rav Yosef Bechor Shor has this passage on the verse that says, "Pe el pe adaber bo umare velo bechidot." God is talking about the way in which he spoke to Moshe, and says that he spoke to Moshe not with chidot. It's not in riddles, to which Rav Yosef Bechor Shor says, "Uvachan nishberu zeroam shel umot haolam sheomrim al ma sheamar Moshe Rabbeinu allegoria hem." Thus the arm of the nations of the world is broken, for they say that what Moses, our teacher, said is an allegory, that is a riddle and a parable, and it doesn't mean what he actually says. And they change his prophecy into something else, and they totally distort his meaning. Concerning them, David said, he speaks his words to Yaakov, his laws and his statute to Israel. He has not done thus to any other nation. He does not make known to them his statute. We are the ones who understand the Torah. They don't understand it. Even though they have translated the Torah from the holy tongue into their language, the Blessed Holy One has not given them a heart for understanding, eyes for seeing, and ears for hearing, for instead they changed the words to mean something that was never intended. So we see here, this is a good summary of Jewish-Christian polemics in the heydays of these polemics in the middle of the Middle Ages, with the Christians saying, as we saw before, that the Jews are fools for taking these laws literally, and the Jews are saying the Christians are fools for saying that these laws that were obviously meant literally ought to be understood allegorically. And so Jews are opposing allegorical understanding, and although some Jews, like Yosef HaMekaneh, say are happy putting forward the idea in discussions with Christians that we love God and we don't care about the logic of what God said to us, most Jews over the ages in this period of strong polemics between Jews and Christians felt a strong impetus that they should be providing reasons for the mitzvot. And maybe we'll look at one further example of Rashbam trying to provide a reason for a mitzvot, and it's on the verse that says, "Et chukotai tishmoru, keep my chukim," and this is one of the verses we saw 2 weeks ago. This is one of the verses on which Rashi said that chukim are laws, she'ein lahem ta'am, that do not have any reason for them. Personally, there's a dispute in the circles of Jewish scholarship about how much Rashi, when he wrote his commentary on the Torah, was interested in refuting Christianity. I'm in the camp of the minimalists who think that actually Rashbam was not thinking about Christians at all when he was writing his commentary on the Torah. Rashbam definitely was. Rashbam tells us frequently that he is thinking about, including in this passage, and including on the one that we saw beforehand about Shiluach HaKen, about setting away the mother bird. He says that he's thinking about what it is that the Christians are saying. So Rashi, when Rashi says these rules, ein lahem ta'am, he also says that the nations of the world make fun of them, but he doesn't feel that that obligates him to try to come up with reasons for them. Rashbam, on the other hand, thinks that that's what a loyal Jew ought to be doing, is trying to come up with reasons for these mitzvot. And so he provides an explanation. As far as I know, he was only the second Jew in history to try this explanation. The first one was Philo of Alexandria, who said things like this back 1,200 years before Rashbam. And Rashbam definitely did not read Philo. Philo's works had not been translated into any language that Rashbam was capable of reading. So if you're looking for a logical explanation of behemtecha lo tarbia kilaim, sadcha lo tizra kilaim, uveged kilaim shatnez lo alecha, that you shouldn't mate two animals of two different species with each other, you shouldn't sow in your field seeds of two different kinds of grain together, and you shouldn't wear shatnez, you shouldn't wear clothing that is made out of wool and out of linen. So Rashbam gives a general, he said, you want an answer, you want an explanation about why there are mitzvot of this nature? He writes, an explanation that is in a conformance with the way of the world and that is appropriate for rebutting the heretics. The same thing that he said before that we saw about Shiluach HaKen. Here's an explanation that's based on just the understanding that we have of the world. We live in this world. We see how this world works. We understand how this world works. And also, this explanation is useful for rebutting what the heretics say. And I'm certain that what the heretics are saying is, this doesn't make any sense. These laws don't make any sense. So the Rashbam says, just as scripture in the creation story commanded each species to produce fruit according to its own kind, limino, so it commanded that we conduct the affairs of the world in a similar manner. This is like imitatio Dei, like copying what God did. God created the world so that the minim, the species, this is a different meaning of the word minim, not the heretics meaning, but the word mean, meaning species. So God wanted the trees to produce fruit, limino, as Rashi explains there, you know, that an apple tree produces apples and that an orange tree, the minim are kept separate from each other. So also we are supposed to follow in God's pattern and keep the different minim, the different species separate from us. So the Torah commanded that we should conduct the affairs of the world in a similar manner when it comes to animals or fields or fruit trees or plowing with an ox and an ass, two separate species together. So I assume that that at some point you have heard an explanation of this nature for these rules of kilayim and kilei behema and shatnez, keeping the species separate from each other, and Rashbam puts it, surprisingly theologically in terms of imitating God. That this is what God did in the beginning when he created the world. Rashbam is not big on theological explanations, but that is what he is that is what he's doing here. And he says, and this also applies to shatnez. V'gam b'tzemer u'fishtim sheze min behemot v'ze min karka v'gidulav. Similarly, one should explain the restriction against wearing wool and linen together. It is outlawed because it is an illicit combination of two categories, since the former is from an animal, and the latter is from the category of things that grow in the ground. So we've got the animal world and the vegetable world, and never the twain shall meet, says Rashbam, or at least the twain should not meet on your back. You should not be wearing clothing that is a combination of something from the animal kingdom and something from the vegetable kingdom. And so that's the idea behind this. And then, surprisingly, Rashbam does not stop his comment there, but he tells you a little story. He says, V'laminim amarti, to the heretics, to the Christians, I said, Hatzemer tzavua, v'apishtan einenu tzavua, v'kapid bebeger shel shnei marot, v'hoduli. I said that the text outlawed clothing of two different colors, since wool is generally colored, but linen is not colored, and they accepted this explanation. Now, notice that in the beginning of this comment, he also said, here's a useful explanation. It's an explanation that works in conformance with the way that the world works, and it's also appropriate for rebutting the heretics. But then he says, he just reports, you know, in a conversation that I had with Christians, they were bugging me about this. And I said to them, well, you know, that wool is usually colored and linen is usually not colored. And somebody who knows much more about medieval clothing than I do told me that, in fact, in most of medieval times, people did not wear multicolored clothing. I had been planning on wearing a multicolored shirt for this evening's session, but I went on a bike ride earlier and I decided that I should change shirts beforehand. But we wear multicolored clothing, but in medieval times, it is possible that the only people who wore multicolored clothing were royalty or extremely rich nobles. And so, you know, I explained to the Christians that the Bible doesn't want the Peshitta Yidden, the regular Jews, wearing this clothing that's partially colored and partially white. And they said, oh, that makes sense. They accepted this explanation. Rashbam is saying this with a kind of smile here, that he's suggesting if you find yourself in a conversation with a Christian, you can try this line if you'd like. But even though before that, he gave another explanation that he thought was the better explanation. A number of you people who study Gemara may know that you find things like this in the Gemara from time to time. When a rabbi gets into a discussion with some Gentile or with some heretic, and then he gives an answer, and then his students say to him afterwards, "Oto dachita bekanesh el kash." Okay, that's the answer that you gave to this guy who asked the question. Lanu ma ta omer, but what are you going to say to us? So you know, there are multiple levels of answers. There are two attempts at an answer of what the ta'ameh mitzvot are here, and they are both meant for polemical purposes, to defend Judaism against the arguments of the Christians. And it appears to me that the first one Rashbam is offering and saying, I really think that this is a good explanation. And then the second one he's saying, you know, here's something that could also work. Here's something that I tried in a discussion that I was once having with the Christians, and it worked. And so Rashbam is providing, in the same way that Nitzachon Yashan and Yosef HaMekaneh, those polemical works that we saw earlier, are providing a primer to help Jews who find themselves in arguments with Christians, that is what Rashbam is doing here. And we find that very often the passages in Rashbam that are Lichuvat HaMinim are Ta'amei HaMitzvot explanations. The Ta'amei HaMitzvot are there in order to answer the accusations of the Christians. And it is not just Rashbam who does this. I bring examples from Rashbam, I admit, because I know Rashbam better than I know other texts, and it's easier for me to find examples of this nature. And also, he's more open about it in saying that this answer that I'm giving is lichuvat haminim, and a lot of people don't say that. And so I think this was a common reason the Jews indulged in ta'amei hamitzvot in medieval times was because of Jewish discussions, arguments, polemics with Christians. Okay, I think I will leave it here and take a look at the chat and see if we can go back to the beginning. Yes. Jonathan Malevsky, you see the birds of the sky, your heavenly father feeds them. Yes, that same idea that that a preacher ought to get a salary. Does not the Midrash Rabbah also interpret circumcision allegorically? No, I wouldn't say that, but the idea of circumcision of the heart that's in the Bible itself. The Torah says, Umaltem et orlat levavchem. So that there is an allegorical understanding of circumcision in the Bible itself, but not as a replacement for the literal understanding of it. It's not saying, Philo made this so clear 2,000 years ago, that he said, when I offer an allegorical interpretation of a biblical text, it is not because I'm saying that that's the only interpretation or the most important interpretation of the biblical text. It's because I'm saying that a text has more than one level of understanding for it. Okay. Somebody asked for my email address, Lockshin, LOCKSHIN, at YorkU, YORKU, .ca. Did you get that, Susan? I hope you did. Otherwise, I'll write down your address and send you Susan Hornstein at yahoo.com. And please, I'm happy to get questions by email from anyone. And yes. And Jonathan Malevsky says maybe it was the other tar phone. Yes, for sure. It could have very well been that there was more than one tar phone, and that this isn't the famous Rabbi Tar phone who was the one who who disagreed most often with Rabbi Akiva. Okay, it was wonderful seeing you all. We will have our last session next week. Rabbi Kelman, do you want to make an announcement about what's coming up?
All right, I guess this is the unofficial announcement. We haven't yet announced it officially, as I was mentioning earlier. It's true, next week is Dr. Lakshin's last class in this series, but actually, I think it works out. You'll be teaching the following Tuesday.
I think that's right.
Because we're starting, please God, Monday, July the 6th, what I call 24 and 8, time for Tanakh. We'll be doing all 24 books in Tanakh, 24 different scholars, 24 different books, 24 different classes, Monday, Tuesday, and Thursdays, 11 a.m., like we do now, 11 a.m. Eastern, 6 in Israel, going through the 24 books of Tanakh. Please God, later today or tomorrow, you'll get an email. You will have to register, like, because it's a whole separate thing, and just to keep track of who's where. So I will ask you to spend the 1 minute to register for that. There'll be a different password to get in. And please God, we look forward to that. And that'll be sort of our big project in the summer, other things. And Dr. Lakshin is doing Sefer Shmot, the way it works out, which happens to be 2 weeks today. So he'll be here the next 2 weeks on Tuesday morning. But I think Rabbi Marty, you'll agree, we have a phenomenal lineup of speakers. And I was so impressed. I strongly encourage everybody. We'll send out the email where I think we have about 20 of the books covered. We're still filling in the details. We put this together over the last week or so, and just giving you a heads up for being here. Anyway, our next class here live is tomorrow evening. Naomi Seidman is finishing her four-part fascinating series on the founding of Beis Yaakov. So that's 8:30 p.m. tomorrow evening. Eastern, 3:30 a.m. in Israel, for those who go to bed late or wake up early. I'm not sure 3:30 which that qualifies for. And Thursday morning, Arvi Zivotofsky will be continuing his animal series, where he talked last week on Lo Tachsom Shor B'Disho.
He had pictures.
It's amazing in how many of our classes there's overlap. You know, mention things. It's beautiful. I think it's beautiful. He showed pictures of farmers from the Library of Congress, like 100 years ago, how they did farm. And you mamash see Lo Tachsom Shor, they violated this prohibition of Lo Tachsom Shor B'Disho. And he said, Shor B'Chamor Yachtav. And he showed all the pictures of people who were harvesting using Shor B'Chamor Yachtav. So that's Thursday morning. And please God, continuing, like I say, all through the summer, we look forward to seeing you in many learning opportunities. And be well, be healthy, and we should hear only good things. Okay.
I thought I'd just make one more comment. I just noticed that Rosemary Linsider is here. And I mentioned the dispute among scholars about whether Rashi, in his commentary on the Torah, paid attention to the Christians. Rosemary's husband, Zichrono Livracha, translated the wonderful book by Avram Grossman about Rashi that I agree with almost everything in that book, except that Avram Grossman is in the camp of saying that Rashi is thinking about Christians all the time and in his writing. I don't blame your husband. He was just the translator. just seeing you here.
Nechama Leibowitz, of course, is in your, and you're in her camp. She's in your camp, of course. Nechama didn't like that at all. That Rashi, right. Any to an extreme, like a lot of her run, right. It's hard to say there's no influence, but that's for another time. Everybody's influenced a little bit by their surroundings.
Right.
And the Christian polemic was so strong, it's hard to believe that every Parshan had to deal with that on some level, at least a little bit. But yes, I agree. You don't really see it in Rashi. Radak, you see it all over.
Radak for sure in Rashbam. And Rashbam is, open about it, as he is about most things. He just lets it all hang out. He makes it very clear what he's doing.
Okay.
Okay, see you all.